Welcome back to the program. As we face a world of increasing complexity, of growing problems, it often seems that the holy grail always seems to be that science will solve our problems. Maybe, maybe not. However, science is only half the equation. To understand and deconstruct our world and the crisis that we face is not just the job of science. It takes the creative, practical solutions that come from engineering. If science is about ideas, then engineering is really about putting those ideas into action. We're going to talk about that today with a guest that has been with us before. It is a pleasure to have him back. He is Henry Petrosky. He's the Alexander S. Visick Professor of Civil Engineering and a Professor of History at Duke University. He's the author of numerous books, including The Pencil into Engineer is Human. It is my pleasure to have him here to talk about his latest, The Essential Engineer. It's just out from Knopf. Henry Petrosky, thanks so much for joining us.
Oh, you're welcome.
Great to have you here. Talk first, in your view, about the difference between science and engineering.
Well, one way of distinguishing scientists from engineers is to look at what they do. And scientists principally want to understand the world, understand the universe, understand things as they are. Engineers, on the other hand, are very much interested in either creating new things or improving things that already exist. So it's a question of trying to understand versus trying to do.
And oftentimes, as you talk about, there's a confusion between the two, and engineers always seem to come up on the short end of the stick.
Well, that's right. It's a standard joke or lament among engineers that when in the space race, for example, if a rocket succeeded, that was a scientific achievement. If it failed on the launch pad, that was an engineering failure. And there is this feeling that scientists get credit for the good, engineers get blamed for the bad.
In practical terms, what is the relationship oftentimes between scientists and engineers and the way in which they do or don't work together?
Well, it can either be healthy or dysfunctional. We all, you know about R&D programs, research and development. Industry has it. Companies have an R&D division. The government sponsors research and development. And generally speaking, the research is the scientific part of it. It's studying, trying to get background information. There's the development. That's the engineering part. Too often in situations, the research and the development are separated. They really don't interact together. There isn't feedback, if you will. So there'll be a research phase, and scientists will get something to work in principle. They might even get it to work in a benchtop experiment on a small scale, a laboratory scale. But then the development problem, which is typically associated with engineers, that can take a very long time, and it can reveal all sorts of new things and new problems, because things that work in the laboratory in an environment that's ideal may not work as well in the real world or when they're scaled up into industrial size plants, if they were talking about producing something.
Right. There's also this issue of timing and the disconnect that exists there. You mentioned rocket science a few minutes ago. That was a situation where, as you talk about, the physics of space flight were things that were solved many, many, many years ago. Translating that into practical application was a whole different business.
That's right. Understanding the orbits of the planets, and by extension then understanding orbits of satellites, those are scientific things, and they obviously work. The planets work, and we know satellites work. But getting that first satellite up there, doing it as a pioneer, was very, very difficult. Developing the rockets was generally done by, early on, a lot of what would be called today perhaps enthusiasts. They were people that had a visceral feeling that they could build rockets that would work, that wouldn't explode. And they experimented, and they finally began to get better and better at it, and eventually did develop rockets. And in fact, they developed rockets long before there actually was rocket science, which studies the way the rockets work.
Part of it is, and you talk about this in the book, that the scientific aspect of it is so much more romantic, that scientists, as you say, imagine the unimaginable, whereas engineers have to manage the projects.
That's right. science is sort of a pure endeavor. Engineering has to worry about the messy things like friction, things like getting enough money to pay for the project, doing things within budget, and so forth. The one old definition of engineering that comes from the 19th century when they were pushing the railroads through was that anybody can lay out a railroad, but an engineer can do it for half the price. The idea of economics is always key to engineering. We've got limited resources, and that's very evident right now with the political climate, the economic climate, mm-hmm. even globally, that we just can't throw money at problems. If we do, we're going to run out of money, obviously, if we haven't already. So we have to think carefully, and we have to plan carefully, and we have to spend the money rather efficiently.
There's also this sense of the frustration that comes from engineering sometimes, because it's easy to say that something is possible theoretically within the realm of science, but bringing it to fruition can take years and years and years, as we're talking about, and oftentimes it will appear as if the solution can't be solved.
Well, that's right. It can be a very frustrating experience to try to engineer something new, something from scratch. But we have all sorts of historical examples where it was accomplished. We have, you know, the Wright brothers. We have the landing on the moon and so forth. The other side of the coin also is interesting, in that scientists have historical examples claimed that something was not possible. It either violated the laws of nature, or that because the scientists understood those laws so much, the engineers couldn't do what they were hoping to do. One classic example of this is steamships that were going to go across the ocean. Before there were steamships, of course, ships relied on sails, which meant they relied on the wind, which meant that if the weather was bad and the wind wasn't blowing, the ship didn't make very much progress. This meant that you really couldn't schedule shipping, because you never knew when that ship from England was going to land in, say, Boston. You just had to wait for the ship to come and then get the word out, well, the ship's going to go back now. But with steam engines in ships, then you could really be predictable. And you could say, well, we're going to get there in 2 weeks, and then we're going to sail the next day back, and we'll get back there 2 weeks. But the scientists said that in order to carry enough coal to burn to get your steamboat across the ocean, it would have to be so large that it would just defeat itself, because the larger you tried to make it, the more coal you would have to burn, and so forth and so on. And they basically said this was an impossible task. But the engineers felt that they could overcome this, because they began to look at the science. And this often happens, that there's sort of simple science, and then there's more complicated science, in the sense that it's out there to try to accomplish something practical. And when you look at it from a practical point of view, that scientific naysaying, it doesn't really apply. Because as the ship gets larger, its volume, which means its coal-carrying capacity, actually increases at a much greater rate than the resistance it experiences in going through the water.
Mm-hmm. The other example you give that's fascinating, where engineering and technology got way ahead of the science, was with respect to the landing on the moon.
Yeah, well, that's right. One of the motivations for landing on the moon was to bring back samples of the moon rocks and soil so that scientists could understand the so-called geology of the moon. Well, the problem facing the engineers who had to design the lunar lander was, well, how do we design this thing to land on a surface that we don't know anything about, and the scientists are asking us to help them understand it. So that was quite a challenge, but the engineers rose to the occasion, of course, and they did bring back the moon samples, and we do know a lot more about the moon now. So that's one example of engineering helping science, and there are lots of examples of that throughout history also.
Even more so, it seems now, that information technology and the technology of Silicon Valley is often out ahead of or in the service of furthering science.
Yes, and I think that's a very good point, that science increasingly needs technological tools in measuring devices or processing information or computing or whatever we might talk about. So much of science depends upon technology. So it's necessary, as you say, for technology to be out in front.
Talk a little bit about the way in which engineers get way out ahead of the science and in some ways teach the scientists.
Mm-hmm. Well, basically, if you have a very distinct goal or problem that you're trying to solve, such as powered flight, which is what the Wright brothers basically were after, the Wright brothers looked around for all the scientific help they could get. They tried to see what was written, what was said. They wrote to the Smithsonian Institution asking, what kind of information do you have that would help us design our airplane? And they didn't get much help. There was very little science, basic science of what today we would call aerodynamics. And as a result, the Wright brothers were forced to basically go and do their own science. They sort of had to lift themselves up by their own bootstraps. But what kept them going is they had a very distinct goal, and that was to design a plane that would fly under power. And scientists don't have those kinds of goals so much. The goals that scientists generally have are, well, we want to understand this more, or we want to understand that more. We want to know this more precisely. It's knowledge that the scientists tend to seek. And if they encounter roadblocks, well, they can modify their approach, but it's not critical. They don't have to ship an airplane out, you know,
right,
to keep their heads above water.
And, of course, all of this results, as you talk about, in really big cultural differences between the two worlds.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, science and engineering are two worlds, and scientists and engineers seem like two different kinds of people. It's an ongoing frustration for people like me to try to figure out, is it the field and what engineers do and what scientists do that attracts different kinds of people, or do different kinds of people shape the fields to be different? And I don't know that anybody has satisfactorily resolved that, but it's commonly agreed, I believe, that scientists have much more outgoing personalities. They exude much more confidence generally than engineers. They're extroverted, whereas engineers tend to be introverted. I won't say they have self-doubt, because obviously they accomplish great things, but they tend not to toot their horn about it. They tend to work quietly, and I think this is in part because they realize, well, maybe they've produced something that's, you know, wow today, but they recognize all the limitations it has, and even before something is completed, you complete the manufacturing of something, you realize, if you're honest, that, gee, it could be so much better, and they're thinking about the next problem. So there is this difference in psychology, and as I say, whether it's the people that are attracted to the different approaches, or whether it's the field that trains them to be different, that's an open question.
Right. There seems to be a greater emphasis. It's interesting, even in the technological fields, when you see large corporations like General Electric or IBM in talking about the machines they build, the work that they do, and how it's in the service of, you know, various scientific endeavors, or in the service of help, whether it's in the medical field or whatever it may be. But clearly there's a focus that the engineering, that even the manufacturing, is part of the romance of it all.
Yeah, that's right. If you're developing something that has a scientific end, that adds to the appeal and the way the thing is received.
To what extent are we seeing this play out in a pretty significant way, both the good and the bad of all that we're talking about, in the attempts to deal with energy issues?
Well, energy issues that's a good example to draw the contrast. The theory of, let's say, batteries, the way they work, the chemistry of them and so forth, that's old stuff. It's been known for a long time. Fuel cells have existed for over a century, and pretty much we understand how they work. So the science, the basic science, the fundamental principles of these things that are going to help us out of the energy predicament that we feel we're in, they aren't in themselves advancing the situation. They aren't advancing our position. with respect to energy independence. These are engineering problems. It's an engineering problem to get to develop batteries that are more efficient. It's not very glamorous. It's much more glamorous, at least it seems, to reporters, to the media, to report on scientific discoveries than to talk about the drudge work of trying to make this battery, more efficient, to make the fuel cells work more reliably. It's a predicament that engineers face, whatever field they're in.
It's interesting when one thinks about examples of how the two fields have worked together, sort of hand in glove. The best example, arguably, that comes to mind is the creation of the atomic bomb.
Well, that's right. That was the Manhattan Project. It was initiated by scientists who observed that there was this new phenomenon of nuclear fission, and the scientists observed also that uranium was key to controlling this, and they recognized that the enemy, the Germans at the time, were starting to hoard uranium, and the scientists sort of knew through their formal and informal contacts that people around the world were starting to think more and more about fission and how much energy could be released by controlling it. So they persuaded the government, basically, to start the Manhattan Project. So it had its origins in science. But then, once it became a formalized project whose goal was explicitly to develop a bomb that worked on these nuclear principles, then it became really an engineering problem. And engineering is not something that just engineers do. Scientists can do engineering, and engineers can do science, and this is where it gets a little complicated. So, but the Manhattan Project was an engineering project by its nature. Uh-huh. And when it was completed, when the bomb was developed, the war was ended, which was always the objective also, then it seems that the scientists not only got credit, but accepted it gladly. And very few engineers got very much press or got very much recognition for what they were doing, or did the project itself get the recognition as an engineering achievement. Hmm. And obviously it shows if you can do that kind of thing for weapons development, you should be able to do equally significant and ambitious projects for, let's say, energy right now.
Right. I mean, people talk about a Manhattan Project somehow for alternative energy.
Mm-hmm.
A couple of years ago, maybe more than a couple, but a few years ago, somebody wrote a book entitled The End of Science, in which they argued that essentially we had pretty much transcribed nature, that we understood the fundamentals of science in most areas, and that it really was up to the engineers, which really is the conclusion of this, that it's up to the engineers to take that science and to turn it into solving the problems of the future.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's right. Of course, there's a political component to it, and the political debate is in part how much should the government fund the development of new energy, or how much should that be left to private industry. And this is happening around the world, actually. This is not something unique to the United States. Germany, Spain have put a lot of money, government money, into solar energy, for example. And they've had quite a bit of success, except in the economic realm. Their success has been achieved at great cost, because the government was just throwing money at it. If this whole solar energy in those countries basically can't survive without subsidies. And the question for the United States and other governments now then is, well, if we really want to go solar in a big way, do we want to do it and have it forever subsidized, or do we want to try to develop it to the point where it really is competitive? And it simply is not right now.
Well, this is this ongoing debate between the development of something and its ongoing nature. I mean, the Internet is the classic example of that that wouldn't have happened without government money, without military dollars, and, of course, it's turned into something very different.
Well, the Internet has had the advantage, I would say, of an enormous increase in the power of computers over this period during which it developed. If we were still back in the age of, say, the 1980s, when we had computers, you know, desktop computers with, you know, 64K of memory or something like that, I don't know that the Internet would be what it is today. Maybe it wouldn't even be at all.
Mm-hmm.
So there was that happy circumstance that it was a problem. It was something that could grow because the technology was also growing so quickly. In the case of energy, the technology hasn't grown that quickly. If you look over the course of the couple centuries, really, that batteries have existed, we've made advances, but they haven't been the kinds of advances that the silicon chips have experienced, for example.
Is part of the problem, as you touch on in the book, that some of the ideas that come out of engineering to solve big problems seem too simple on the surface, too practical?
Well, yeah, sometimes that's the case. They don't have the glitz. You know, you pick up a newspaper, say the New York Times, and every Tuesday they have a section called Science Times, and they have a lot of stories about the subatomic world and how physicists are looking at trying to figure out whether it's operated by strings or springs or whatever, really metaphorical interpretations of what's happening. I find some of these articles actually very difficult to get through and to fully understand. Now, I'm sure people working in their fields, they understand them. But engineering very seldom makes that section of the newspaper.
On the other hand, if somebody hadn't figured out how to build the superconductor supercollider in Switzerland, we wouldn't understand any of this.
Well, that's right. That's another example of technology being in the service of science. And there obviously a lot of money contributed by a lot of governments. It's an international cooperative deal for this purpose. Now, why? Why don't those same governments, those same entities contribute, get together for, you know, purposes of making a better battery, let's say, and, you know, really just, you know, throwing money at it? I think partly it's not as glamorous a thing, but I think fundamentally it must have something to do with the physicists being very, very persuasive. You know, they're better lobbyists, they're better salespeople.
What happens and how does this apply to the medical realm and bioresearch?
Well, I think the similar things happen. Interesting about the medical realm, I teach at an institution where we have a big medical school as well as an engineering school, and there's a lot of cooperation among the engineers and the medical doctors. In fact, a lot of them have actually several titles. They might be a professor of surgery and at the same time a professor of biomedical engineering. And what they really seem to know how to cooperate. But one thing that is generally not widely appreciated is how much engineering actually goes into developing medical devices, and not only the mechanical devices, but the procedures, the processes, and even something like drug delivery. There's a lot of engineering in getting a drug encapsulated in materials, and they are materials that have to be studied and have to be developed by engineers that will hold the drug in until it gets to its targeted area in the body to treat, say, a tumor or something. This is engineering, pure and simple. If a surgeon is going to open up somebody and do some back surgery on that person, there are a lot of engineering devices that have to be involved, and just understanding how the body is like a machine in order to operate on it properly without overstressing it and breaking it, literally.
Of course, the other aspect, as you've written about in previous books, is the aesthetic consideration in engineering.
Mm-hmm. Yes, well, engineers do like to think about what they call often elegant solutions, solutions that are simple, straightforward, and yet at the same time beautiful, not only conceptually, but also things of beauty to behold, a beautiful sailboat that might win the America's Cup, for example. It's an underrated aspect of engineering. Design is often associated more with architects and industrial designers and so forth. I often like to use the simple example of a paperclip. If every now and then a feature will appear in the newspaper, what are the 10 best designs of all time? And invariably the paperclip will be named. And there'll be a picture of it there, and it's sitting on the paper, and it's beautiful. It's got these wonderful loops within loops. It's got all this symmetry. But an engineer doesn't see a paperclip that way, because engineers don't design things to sit on pieces of paper to be admired. The engineer also knows that it's supposed to work. It's supposed to clip papers together. That its whole name comes from the function it serves. So engineers worry more about how it's going to work. How much spring does it have? Will it be able to maintain its shape? And when you put a paperclip on a pile of papers, it becomes, it's not a pretty object anymore. It's actually kind of an awkward looking object. So it's a difference between looking at something and saying the aesthetics is all there is, or looking at something and recognizing that there has to be a balance between how the thing looks in the abstract and how it looks when it's actually in service, when it's actually doing its job.
How does all of this relate, finally, to issues of public policy with respect not only to money and government policy, but also in terms of how we teach this in our universities? We see a lot of science happening in our great research universities, and a lot less emphasis in some cases on engineering, and a lot more emphasis on engineers coming from overseas, particularly from Asia.
Yes, well, that's right. A lot of our engineering students these days may study engineering, but only as a means to an end, which is not engineering. A lot of students at my university, for example, will study biomedical engineering. They'll get a degree in biomedical engineering. And what's motivating them? Well, they really want to go to medical school. They want to be medical doctors, and they feel that this is a way of they're studying. They're studying biology. They're studying biological sciences as a background to their engineering. But their real objective is to distinguish their application to medical school by being an engineering major rather than, say, a chemistry major, which is kind of ordinary in a certain sense.
And why do we see so many more engineers, in fact, a shortage of engineers domestically, more engineers, particularly in the Silicon Valley, coming from India and China?
Well, the populations are just enormous, of course, for one thing. I mean, China counts, its population in billions, and we count still in hundreds of millions. So that's one thing, I think. I think there is a greater respect for engineering in those cultures, in those India and China specifically. Engineering in Europe is also much more respected. In this country, engineering is sometimes seen as, well, that's maybe an entry-level job. It's if you're the first in your family to go to college, maybe you study engineering. But there are many, many counterexamples. There are many people who came from I'm talking historically now, who came from very distinguished families, very influential families, and their parents, in some cases, were actually disappointed that these people wanted to study engineering rather than go into the law and join the family firm or the family bank. But the kinds of engineers I'm talking about, they were driven. They saw this really strong connection between engineering and public policy, engineering and the common good, the achievements of engineers. And they developed the infrastructure of our cities. They're largely unknown, but their stories are legion, really. It's just that they're not told. I just read an obituary in this morning's newspaper about an architect who had died, and he Bruce Graham, and he was very important in developing skyscrapers, especially in Chicago. And the obituary described a lot of his work. It only toward the end did it mention something that was key to the achievements that, that he made, and that was that he worked closely with engineers. And he didn't just do architecture. He recognized that there was an engineering component to getting these buildings to work as buildings, as machines, big, tall machines. Interestingly, the illustration in the newspaper got the wrong building. It wasn't. Well, that's another story. I digress.
Henry Petrosky, his book is The Essential Engineer, Why Science Alone Will Not Solve Our Global Problems. It's just out from Knopf. Henry, always a pleasure. I thank you so much for being with us.
Well, thank you. It's good to be with you again.